This is Teresa Caraggio with Third Paradigm, a radio blog about community sovereignty and regenerative economics. I'm here today with Phyllis Bennis, who is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in DC and the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. She's authored many books on the Middle East and U.S. foreign policy, including Ending the Iraq War, a primer, Before and After U.S. Foreign Policy and the War on Terrorism, Understanding the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, a primer, and Challenging Empire. Phyllis is also co-founder of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation and author of Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's UN. Welcome, Phyllis.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
I'd like to start by putting in a plug for World Beat and John Pfeffer in the Institute for Policy Studies.
Thank you.
I think that if I were ever to simplify my life and reduce all of the informational emails that I get to just one, it would be Foreign Policy in Focus and the World Beat.
I'm glad. I'll be sure to tell John and Amira and the rest of the team that now, they should keep it up.
Now, that would be cheating, of course, because how many journalists are there that is a coalition of?
Over 600. Journalists, wow. Academics, activists, all over the world. It's a fabulous think tank without walls, as we call it.
Yes. And John Pfeffer, I think, is one of the great straight men, that he has this wonderful deadpan style where he's writing, of course, about these incredibly serious topics and pulling together all of these different articles from around the world, but he puts them in the form of some analogy that's often very flippant.
Yes, and he can be as snarky as the rest of us, and we like that.
I also know Amira because she and I have worked together on the Stop Firestone campaign.
It's a brilliant campaign, and Amira, of course, who has Liberian roots, is very much at the centerpiece of it, and it's been a brilliant campaign. You know that. I'm sure you've talked with your listeners about it, the campaign to focus on child labor at the Firestone Rubber Company in Liberia. At a moment when Liberia is being touted as this great new democratic possibility for Africa, first woman president elected for the first time, and it turns out that Firestone is still doing all the bad old colonial stuff there, and so that victory has been a very sweet one.
You know, I had no idea that we were going to be able to get into such depth on so many different topics.
Well, I'm not sure that would count as depth.
I also work with Manuel Perez Roca at the Alliance for Responsible Trade, which Tom Loudon runs out of the Quixote Center.
Right.
In my last episode, I was advising any young activist that if they really wanted to get to the heart of the issues, to study two things, trade agreements and where the money goes.
Absolutely, it's always the case.
That seems to be related to the topic that you're going to be talking about tonight, with the whether can Israel be stopped through nonviolent means of the boycott, divest, and sanctions.
Right. I mean, the question that we face now is that we have a very different country with a very different president, with a very different approach to the situation in the Middle East and what U.S. policy should be in the Middle East. But that new set of ideas, that new approach, the new president, the new country, has not yet led to any change. As of this moment, the U.S. is still providing $30 billion over the next 10 years in unchallengeable U.S. military aid to Israel.
And Obama has increased that by $225 million for 2010, which I believe is a statistic I've gotten from you.
Well, the arrangement had been made ahead of time. I mean, he's sort of saying he's going to implement what George Bush promised. That's bad enough. However, the statements that have been made recently are very, very promising because they do reflect a very changed political approach. That is, the statements that there must be a complete halt in settlement activity, particularly Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's statement that there must be a complete halt, and she specifically mentioned no exceptions for so-called natural growth of the settlements, a usual Israeli diversionary attack, no exceptions by relying on the so-called demolition of the outposts, which are a real diversion of attention, but that all settlement activity has to end. Now, that's not a big deal on one level. It's something that has been an Israeli obligation for years to not only freeze but reverse the settlements. Mm-hmm. It was the freezing of settlements was something Israel agreed to do in the so-called roadmap of 2003. However, under George Bush, that issue was never raised. There was no accountability. The fact that it's been raised very early on in the Obama administration is very hopeful. However, it's the yin and the yang of all this. I don't know which one is which, but the other one, if that's the yin, the yang is that there has not yet been any indication, either by word or by deed, that President Obama has the intention of actually holding Israel accountable to the obligation of freezing settlements, which would require, I think most people believe, serious pressure in the form of, for example, holding the U.S. aid, the military aid, conditioned on Israeli compliance. So instead of the $3 billion or so this year that Israel is supposed to get, President Obama could simply tell Prime Minister Netanyahu, you know what, we promised you $3 billion, and you'll get it as soon as you start complying with international law and freeze all the settlements without exception.
Now that would be a real sanction.
That would be a real sanction.
The question I have is, are the things that we can buy or not buy, does that make a difference when it comes to withholding that amount of military aid?
Well, the question, when you talk about us, when you talk about people, you mm-hmm. know, we can't boycott the products made by Raytheon and General Dynamics. We don't buy F-16 fighter bombers and Apache helicopter gunships and TOW missiles, so we can't boycott them. What we can do, and this was the reason for the brilliance, I think, of the BDS campaign, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions.
Which I first heard about from Naomi Klein.
Mm-hmm. This is a campaign that has been underway for many years now. It began in the summer of 2005 with the call from a number of Palestinian civil society organizations who said, we have learned the lessons of the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, that nonviolent economic pressure is one of the most effective ways of bringing pressure to bear on, in this case, an illegal occupying power, mm-hmm. Israel. And the brilliance of that analysis is that it recognizes, number one, you need a global campaign that everybody all over the world can participate in. But at the same time, you have to recognize that conditions are different in every country. So in some countries, say Argentina or India or Brazil, these are countries whose governments buy a lot of military equipment from Israel. So there can be, and is, in those countries, a campaign for military sanctions, meaning stop buying any military anything from Israel.
Right.
Now, in the U.S., that's beginning to take shape now in our campaign against U.S. military aid to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But the brilliance of it, again, is that in other countries, for example, in Europe, the European countries are not buying so much military stuff from Israel, but they are buying a ton of produce that's grown, produced in the occupied territories on illegal Israeli settlements and is being slipped into Europe under the terms of an Israeli-European agreement that is supposed to involve only goods actually produced inside the Green Line, inside pre-67 Israel, not to include settlements. All the stuff is coming in, and so the big campaign across Europe is for individual boycotts of produce, whether it's tomatoes, dates, cut flowers, a whole range of produce that's grown in occupied Palestinian territory. In the United States, the main part of our work has been around divestment, looking at the role of corporations who are profiting from occupation and saying, we don't want our institutions, whether it's retirement funds, union trust funds, university trusts that are funding the universities, or things like municipal governmental decisions, that sort of thing. So, for example, the two big national campaigns for divestment in the U.S. are against Caterpillar Corporation mm-hmm. and Motorola. Caterpillar, because the great D9 bulldozer, which is a monstrosity, 24-foot high, monstrous-looking thing, is specifically produced in Illinois, Peoria, Illinois, specially made to accept Israeli armored plating so it can be used as a weapon of war. Mm-hmm. And indeed, it is used all over the occupied territories to demolish Palestinian homes, to uproot olive groves, some of which are hundreds of years old. And of course, in early 2003, it was a Israeli soldier driving a Caterpillar D9 bulldozer that killed Rachel Corrie. So that's the reason. And now, most of us in this country don't go out and buy bulldozers and tractors every other day. There's a few farmers maybe who do, but everybody lives in a community. And every community has to buy snow removal equipment, tractors for the parks. Universities buy backhoes to keep the lawns looking good. Mm-hmm. Caterpillar makes all that stuff. All of those communities can be the venue for an incredibly great campaign of education about why next year, when UC Santa Cruz has to buy 3 new backhoes for the campus, mm-hmm. they should not be Caterpillar.
Right.
They can buy any other kind, John Deere, whatever. All of which corporations are probably doing their own bad things somewhere. Mm-hmm. But there is a targeted campaign against Caterpillar that gives us all, by engaging in that work locally, it makes us part of a national and indeed global movement. The other one is Motorola. Now, Motorola makes these hot cell phones that students love. Now, I understand that they're not the hottest one on the market anymore. Something else has superseded them. The iPhone, I think, is now more popular. I don't know. I don't keep up with that stuff. It's a generational thing. But whatever. They make cell phones, perfectly good cell phones. Nothing wrong with their cell phones. What's wrong with Motorola, and the reason we say hang up on Moto, is that their other divisions are producing communication systems designed specifically to enable and strengthen the Jews-only settlements throughout mm-hmm. the occupied West Bank. And, crucially, the Israeli military, the IDF, buys fully made communication systems from Motorola that enable their operations in the West Bank, some of which have actually been linked to targeted assassinations that rely on cell phone technology. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at a pretty horrific set of actions by Motorola. And one way we can have immediate impact on that is to say, next time we buy a new cell phone, you know, young people especially buy new cell phones about every year or two, it's not going to be Motorola. And the key is the education part. So it means you don't just not buy it.
Right.
You go into Radio Shack and you tell the manager, you know what, I was going to buy a Motorola phone, but I just found out they're doing X, Y, and Z, so I'm not going to buy it. I'm going to buy something else. You tell the Motorola dealer that I don't want their phones.
Right. And what I've noticed is that Working Assets now allows you to buy a refurbished phone for the same price as a new one. Which makes me believe that I'm not the only one who's saying that because of the coltan issue
Absolutely.
And the devastation that it's funding in the Congo,
Absolutely.
I don't want to buy a cell phone at all.
Absolutely a very good plan. I mean, the intersection of these issues, the devastation caused to African countries, to populations, to the environment, because of this sudden demand for coltan all over the world that's mm-hmm. used in cell phones, this is a great opportunity to take it up.
Now, on our station, we play, thanks to Bob, who produces my show, a lot of Al Jazeera. Mm-hmm. And he sent me the most recent interview that you did on Inside Iraq about Israel and whether they are going to make good on their threat to bomb Iran and yeah. what the consequences would be for Iraq. The person who you were debating was the former prime minister of the former, former advisor to the former prime minister?
Yes, he was the key advisor to Ariel Sharon.
Mm.
His name is Yusen, I'm forgetting his name, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I can picture him and I remember what he said. But,
right, he seemed as smug as a person who believes they have a president in their pocket would be.
He may believe that. I think he's wrong.
Mm-hmm. Let's hope so.
I don't think he has this president in his pocket.
Yeah, let's hope so. One of the things that he said that struck me was, well, the reason that we need to do this is because we waited too long to protect ourselves with the Holocaust. And that's a rationale that I've heard before from my Jewish friends, that we as a tribe, you know, as a race, need to protect ourselves. The flaw that I've seen with that is that the Holocaust was ended by an international community of humanitarians who were ready to stand up for any person. It was not ended by people who were saying, well, it's every race against every other, and so we have to protect ourselves. What that says, because the same humanitarians are now protecting Palestinians, what that says is that, you know, that should never have been a reason to say we will protect whoever is being...
Well, I think the basic thrust of your argument is absolutely right, that the defense against anti-Semitism is not to retreat, in my view, into, as the term you used was tribal identity, or we might say narrow identity politics, but rather to link your struggle, in this case against anti-Semitism, to other struggles against racism, against anti-Arab racism, against Islamophobia, against all of these things. You link them and you become stronger. The model of what happened around the Holocaust, though, is a more complex one, I think, because what we did see, yes, the Holocaust ultimately was ended with the defeat of Nazi Germany by an international coalition, but the leading powers of that coalition, most notably, not the Soviet Union so much, but the United States and Britain, refused to allow in the European Jews who had escaped or survived the Holocaust. They didn't want, in most cases, to go to what was then Palestine. They didn't want to go live in the desert, make the desert bloom, all of the slogans of the day. They wanted to go where their families were, which was overwhelmingly Brooklyn and London. You know, they wanted to go to the United States and to the United Kingdom. Because of anti-Semitism and anti-communism, both the US and the UK governments prohibited significant numbers of Jewish refugees from coming into the US and the UK, and instead ensured that they were shunted off to Palestine. That became the only place they could be guaranteed the protection of those major world powers. And what that did was to say, number one, it accomplishes what the US government wanted, which was keep out the Jews and keep out the communists that were assumed to be among the Jews. And two, it made the Palestinians pay the price for the Holocaust, because this was not an empty land. This was not a land without a people for these people who now had no land. You know, the question was, why didn't the victorious Allied powers give the Jewish survivors part of Germany or part of Poland, right, if they wanted to give them somebody else's land?
Right.
Or,
right,
more importantly, on a human level, why didn't they let them go where they wanted to go, which was the United States?
Right.
It was because of anti-Semitism. So it was anti-Semitism that drove those powers to demand that the U.S. only support Jewish settlement after the Holocaust in what was then Palestine, making the indigenous population, the Palestinians, pay the price.
Right.
So that's the contradictions of using this as a model.
A group that I participate with is the Jesus Seminars, which are Bible scholars who get together and study passages and vote on their authenticity. And one of the things that, you know, has come out of that is that as honest Bible scholars, what they can't get around is that the New Testament is an anti-Semitic document. It is a polemic. And James Carroll is an ex-priest who's done an exhaustive study with his book Constantine's Cross, which studies the link between violence against Jews and the Gospels. And what when I'm at the Jesus Seminars, they will some of the fellows are Torah scholars, like A.J. Levine. And because they are the Bible scholars are really embarrassed by this fact. I mean, they can't reconcile it. They can't deny it because they are studying the text. But at the same time, it makes them extremely uncomfortable. And so they bend over backwards to be respectful to AJ and to other Torah scholars. What I've brought up at different meetings is that the Old Testament or the Torah is an anti-Canaanite polemic. What it is based on is that Canaan, Noah's grandson, sinned by his father talking about Noah being drunk and naked, and therefore Noah cursed his grandson and all of his descendants. And if you look at the patriarchs and what it is that they're saying against whoever it is they're saying something against, whether it's Sodom, Gomorrah, whether it's the first sons that don't get the inheritance, it always goes back to Canaan. So it seems to me like we need the same group of honest Torah scholars that we have with honest Bible scholars to say, let's trace the roots of this violence and find out whether it goes back to a scripture which says God likes some people better than others.
I guess I think that that's all interesting, but I don't think that's the root of the problem. I think the root of the problem is struggles over land. It's the same old issues of colonialism as anywhere else. I think in every religion, you can find evidence that your God, whether it's the Jewish God, the Muslim God, the Christian God, the multiple gods of pagan religions or any other gods, Buddhism, Jains, whatever, I think every religion has good stuff and bad stuff, and you can pretty much find whatever you want in the ancient texts. So I don't really think that God wrote real estate contracts. I don't really think that this is why there's fighting going on. And I don't think it legitimates any of it. I don't think on either side. If we find good, what did you say, good Torah scholars that prove that, that's not the answer. I don't think. Because I don't think this is a religious struggle. This is a struggle over land and rights. It's a struggle for human rights and equality. And I think we have to wage the battle on that front. It's interesting for people who believe in God to want to debate this stuff, for people who are tied to specific religions to want to debate their various scriptures. I don't think it's going to answer anything. So I don't see that as the solution here.
So if a Palestinian were to decide to convert to Judaism, mm-hmm. to become circumcised, to practice the rituals, could they do that, and would that then give them the privileges of being...
Presumably, yes. I mean, more than 60% of the Jewish population of Israel are Arabs and Turks and Persians. So they're from Morocco, they're from Yemen, they're from Iraq, they're from Egypt. They're Arabs. Many of them speak Arabic at home, although fewer now, but the older generation does. The Yemenis came in the early 50s, the Iraqis and the Moroccans came earlier. So the Israeli Jews are more than half Arab. So that's the first thing that people have to get their minds around, because there's this assumption that the Jews, according to U.S. policy assumptions, the Jews are like us. Now, on one level it's true, half of them are us, half of them come from Brooklyn. In Israel, the emigration of American Jews is a huge component. But that's not the majority. The majority are not Jews like me. My ancestors are from Eastern Europe. They're not white Europeans like me. They are from Yemen, they're from Morocco, they're from Iran, they're from Turkey. They're Semites. They're Arabs, they're Turks, they're whatever. So could Palestinians convert as well? I assume so, although I think it would be difficult. I think there would be a lot of challenges. But again, that doesn't answer the problem of Palestinians not having the right of return. Because the right of return is a right under international law based on the land, not based on what religion you are.
But what I'm getting at is that I'm not sure it's a religion so much as a race.
Because it's people from all over the world. So the Ethiopian Jews are... Israel is a very racialized society. There's a racial hierarchy. Jews like me are on the top of the pyramid, the white mm-hmm. European Jews. Next come the Russian Jews. Next come the Semites, the what they're called, the Mizrahim, mm-hmm. the Arab, Persian, etc. The bottom is the Ethiopian Jews, the African Jews, who are black. Then at the very bottom come the Palestinians. It's not about, Jews are not a race.
Right.
Jews, you can say their ethnicity, I don't know what it is, but it's identified in Israel as a nationality. Being Jewish is your nationality. And that's what gives you privileges and the right to discriminate. That's why equal rights is the basis for it. Mm-hmm. Conversion is not the answer.
If I were to define religion, what I would call it is a philosophical attempt to reconcile an all-inclusive and loving God with a suffering world.
Okay, and I would say that religion is the opiate of the masses. You can define religion any way you want. I'm just saying, I don't think religion gives us the answer.
But having a document that says that one group of people mm-hmm. has the right to take the land and exert violence
That's
on another
group
of people.
That's what makes Israel in violation of the international covenant against the crime of apartheid. It's because it's a legal system designed to privilege one group and disempower another group. That's the definition of apartheid in the 1973 covenant. Right. And it defines racial groups very broadly, to include religion, ethnicity, language, country of origin, gender, almost any identifiable group mm-hmm. can be either the subject or the object, either the victim or the oppressor in a relationship of apartheid.
Right. But in this case, there is a scripture behind it which gives it the protections.
Well, it doesn't. It might to you, it might to somebody, but it's not the early Zionist movement was an explicitly secular movement that said we are not the same as religious Zionists who talk about next year in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. That we are not that. Mm-hmm. We are a colonial movement. That's the term they used in 1898.
Yeah.
And that's why they wrote letters, Theodore Herzl wrote letters to Cecil Rhodes mm-hmm. saying, I know your interest is Africa, my interest is Arabia, but we both are engaged in colonial projects. Shouldn't we work together?
Right. And one of the many things that I love about your work is that you are someone who has the courage to use the word occupation.
Sure. That one takes a lot of courage. There's other words that take more courage, but that's not one of them. The discourse has changed. You don't have to be brave anymore to do this work. That's one of the great things right now. We're in a moment when there is a huge shift in the discourse. Just look at the difference between the 50th anniversary and the 60th of the Nakba, what the Palestinians call the Nakba, meaning the catastrophe,
yes.
the creation of Israel, which is celebrated as Israeli Independence Day, but mourned and commemorated by Palestinians as the moment that they were, where they lost their land and they lost their mm-hmm. rights, they were dispossessed. In the 50th anniversary, in 1998, you had nothing but Israeli triumphalism. You had the great stories and mythology of the Zionist movement as a national movement. The Jews made the desert bloom. It was a great triumph of Western Westernism over the benighted, dark, what was there before, which we won't talk about.
Mm-hmm.
There was no mention of the Palestinians. Fast forward 10 years, and in 2008, for the 60th anniversary, the word Nakba was on the front page of the New York Times and the Washington Post and the lead story on CBS News and CNN. Palestinians were being interviewed all over the place. Doesn't mean they got it right. It doesn't mean they understood it all. But what a change in discourse mm-hmm. over just 10 years.
Yeah.
So you don't have to be brave anymore to do this. You're now matching public opinion.
Yeah. You do give me great hope by going through how much has changed.
Absolutely.
Because my daughter, my oldest daughter, in her global civilization class, they memorized every country in the world except Palestine, because Palestine didn't even exist on their maps.
Well, there's a reason. Palestine doesn't exist as a country. It's not a country yet. There is a fiction at the United Nations. There's an entity called Palestine, which is the PLO. But there is no Palestine. I'm not surprised. I mean, you can't... that's not something that I would blame the teachers for necessarily. I blame the teachers and the curriculum for a lot more in terms of how they teach the history. I wouldn't worry quite as much now about the maps as long as they included what are occupied territories in Gaza and the West Bank mm-hmm. and East Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
But it's true. We have so far not succeeded in winning the reality of Palestine as a nation.
Yeah. But I think that we who are talking about this are much less isolated than we were before.
Absolutely.
And I just want to end this by thanking you, because I think you have been a great force for making that something that is people know about and have the information to be able to talk about it.
Well, thanks. I hope that people find my primers useful, and the website of the U.S. Campaign to End Israeli Occupation is a great resource, endtheoccupation.org.
Thank you.
Thank you.